It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear from a former UW-Madison men's basketball player who says it's time to start paying college athletes. First, it's time for a weekly look at national politics. After a House vote today, the Republican tax bill is headed to President Trump's desk. Also, the president's lawyers have accused Robert Mueller's investigators of improperly obtaining emails related to the ongoing Russia investigation. And new reports shed light on how the Treasury Department has been paying to settle sexual harassment cases. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you happy to see the Republican tax plan make it through Congress? Are you worried about the possible impact? How do you think it's going to play out politically for Republicans in the year ahead? And what do you think about allegations of bias in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Callum Borchers joins us now. He covers the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
Well, the big news today is the passage of the Republican tax overhaul bill. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan after the Senate had approved the plan last night.
We said in 2016 that it would take real tax reform for families and businesses to get the American economy growing, and we were serious. And the American people placed their trust in us to do this work for them. And today, we're making good on that promise.
So, Callum, a victory lap for Republicans this afternoon?
No question. This is the biggest legislative accomplishment of the Trump presidency by a long shot. It did sort of have to clear an extra hurdle today after a hiccup last night in which, of course, the House and Senate have to pass identical bills. And House held up its end of the bargain, and then the Senate said, oh, hold on a sec. We got to make a couple of tweaks at the end here to follow the Byrd rule. So they did that. They re-voted in the House today, and here we are. And Republicans are right to feel like they have really accomplished something here. I think the question, though, is, you know, sort of how it will be received by the public. You know, congressional Republicans have been marketing this first and foremost as a middle class tax cut. And it is that, at least up front. But of course, most of the benefits are actually weighted toward the upper class and toward corporations. And in fact, the president in his cabinet meeting said today that the corporate tax cut was actually the biggest factor in the bill. So there has been some mixed messaging, you might say.
And this has not been popular in public opinion polls. When people are asked, more people dislike it and distrust this tax plan than like it. Republicans are saying, hey, you're going to see most of you are going to see some kind of tax cut starting right away next year. What are people watching for with the reception of this bill now that it's going to be passed?
Well, for your listeners who saw some of the celebration at the White House maybe an hour or so ago, Republicans were very explicit in what they want their voters to do. They said, start looking at your paycheck in February. That's when you should see an increase. And, of course, that's in line with what Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, said yesterday at a news conference when he was asked about why the bill polls so poorly. And he said, well, look, my feeling is that folks are going to learn to love this bill down the line when they start seeing more money to take home in their paychecks. Now, that may well be the case, but, you know, there's also going to perhaps be some looking askance at, well, what's the guy or the gal who makes more than I taking home? Because I think that what the Republicans are sort of glossing over here is that it's not just that the top earners are taking home more in raw dollar amounts. You would sort of expect that to be the case, right? Because if, you know, if everybody across the board got, say, a 2.2% increase in after-tax income, which is what the average is, according to the Tax Policy Center, well, then obviously the top earners would get more raw dollars out of that, right? I mean, 2% of a larger amount is more than 2% of a smaller amount. That's basic math. But the percentages are also skewed. The Tax Policy Center said that if you're in the lowest fifth of earners in this country, your additional take-home pay is only going to be 0.4%. Now, that's better than nothing, but it's not 2.2%. And if you go to the top earners, the top fifth, well, they're going to take home an extra 2.9%. So it's not just an imbalance in the raw dollar amount. It's also a larger percentage for the top earners as well.
Talking to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post, looking at the big news in national politics, the biggest news right now, the tax plan passed by Congress. I want to bring on a caller now. Tim is on the line in Shell Lake. Tim, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think the tax cut's a good thing, especially the corporate tax cut. It's been proven many times, beginning with John Kennedy's administration, the Reagan tax cut. The economy grows when there's a tax cut, and when the economy grows, it brings more money to the federal government in the form of revenue.
Tim, thanks for the call. We've had economists on the show arguing for and against that point of view, Tim, as far as the supply side economics there. But Tim's definitely in line with what Republicans are selling here, right, Callum?
Well, that's right. I think, though, the question is sort of how much can the economic growth offset the cost of this bill, right? So remember, Republicans went through sort of a special budgeting process here called reconciliation. It's pretty wonky, but it essentially meant that they could pass this with a simple majority. But they had to stay within certain spending constraints. And so what they authorized here was an increase to the federal debt of up to $1 trillion. Now, they have said, of course, that it's not actually going to cost that much money, that we're going to sort of grow the economy, and it's going to offset those expenses, but it's hard to make up the full amount. And if you look at what the nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation estimated, they said, well, you know, maybe a third of that will be compensated for by growth, but you're still going to add about $1 trillion to the debt over the next decade. And so perhaps that's worthwhile. It should goose the economy a little bit, but there is a cost to it as well.
Want to check out the Affordable Care Act angle here. President Trump talked about that a little bit at a White House press conference this afternoon, taking out the individual mandate in this plan.
I hate to say this, but we essentially repealed Obamacare because we got rid of the individual mandate, which was terrible. And that was a primary source of funding of Obamacare.
So Affordable Care Act, I mean, this is something that may have a lot of consequences that we may not know at this point, right, Callum?
Yeah, there's a ripple effect here, and I'm very curious to watch how this is received as well, you know, because recall that when Republicans tried multiple times this year to repeal Obamacare in a more straightforward sense, they got a lot of criticism even from folks on the right, from Breitbart News of all places, which, of course, was one of the president's biggest cheerleaders during the campaign, and the critique was, you're not following through with a clean, full repeal of Obamacare. You're just sort of stripping away one part of it. And so that's really what we're doing here in this tax bill as well. The president is touting the repeal of the individual mandate. That is one big component of the Affordable Care Act for sure. But you certainly couldn't characterize this as a full repeal. And so I just wonder whether the president's base will sort of score this one as a promise kept. Will that be good enough for them, or will they say, well, hold on, this isn't quite what you promised on the campaign trail?
Want to bring on another caller now. Thanks to Tim for his call. Sharon is with us now in Milwaukee. Sharon, hi.
Hi. My question is, with this tax cut, what does it do for the people that make like $40,000 to $70,000 a year? If I understand right, they're taking away tax deductions, and I don't have kids, so that child credit doesn't make a difference. Mine are all grown. How does it help the average working person?
Sharon, thanks for the call. Callum, I don't know if you have all the details for each range, but what do we know about people in that 40 to 70-ish thousand zone?
Yeah, so they would sort of probably fall between that first and second quintile of income earnings. And so the average after-tax income increase for those folks is between 0.4% and 1.2%. So you're going to see some. But again, those are averages. And I think without consulting your sort of individual tax advisor, you'd have to figure out, well, you know, how much of that is based on a credit like the child tax credit that your caller said says she would not be eligible for. And also keep in mind that some of this is location-based. So, you know, the estimate right now from the Tax Policy Center is that about 95% of the country is going to see some amount of tax savings. Well, the other 5%, though, that you're talking about folks in places like New York and New Jersey and California, where you know, you might get hit by the new cap on how much state and local income tax you can deduct, which is $10,000 now. So there may be folks who, yes, they're seeing a dip in their federal tax rate, but they're not able to write off as much of their state income taxes as they were in the past. And so in the net, they see a tax increase. So as with all of these things, it is specific to every individual case. But generally speaking, at least for 2018, the vast majority of taxpayers are going to see at least some reduction.
Sharon, thanks for that call. Before we move on to other issues, Callum, I want to get back to the politics here. Paul Ryan has said, basically, we're ready to run on this in 2018. When asked, he wasn't clear on whether he personally would be running on this in 2018, which is a whole other question. And meanwhile, a poll came out, this is released today, on ballots. Generic Democrat beats generic Republican congressional races something like 16%, which is a huge margin. So the politics of this in 2018, what do you think?
Well, you can see that the Republicans were eyeing 2018 just in the way they structured this bill, right? Because a lot of the benefits, at least for middle-class voters, are front-loaded in this bill. So partly because of the budget process they went through, that reconciliation that we mentioned a moment ago that required them to stay within certain budget constraints, what Republicans did was they built in an expiration date for these tax cuts. So many of the individual tax cuts will sunset, will go away after 2025. Now, Paul Ryan said yesterday and reiterated again today that Congress, he expects, would reauthorize those tax cuts when it comes up. But of course, that's not a sure thing. And as a result, you've had the estimate from the Tax Policy Center that by 2027, a slight majority of taxpayers will actually see a tax increase because of the deductions going away. And so I think the question for 2018 becomes, how are voters looking at this? Are they looking at it just in the short term? Are they going to start looking at those paychecks in February, as Republicans are asking them to do, and say, hey, you know, I do notice a few extra bucks in my paycheck. I'm really happy about that, and I'm more inclined to vote Republican because of it. Or will they sort of have in the back of their minds, but I know this is temporary, and what I've been told is that in the long run, my taxes are actually going to go up, and I'm not happy about it.
Callum Borchers is with us from the Washington Post. It's our weekly roundup of the top news in national politics. We're going to move on to some other issues coming up in just a couple minutes, including the latest on the Mueller investigation, a challenge in how they got some campaign transition emails from the Trump transition team. What do you think about that, about where the investigation is now? You can join us at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Plus some UFOs. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our talk with Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, looking at the biggest political stories of the week. It wasn't all taxes this week, Callum. We saw this challenge from some of President Trump's legal team, I believe, to the Mueller investigation, talking about how they got a whole cache of emails related to the transition. What's going on there?
Right. So just to set this up, we're talking about emails that were exchanged among Trump officials between Election Day and Inauguration Day. And the argument from the Trump team is, look, those should be private property. We weren't government employees yet. We were the incoming administration. And Mueller's team shouldn't have been able to get its hands on it. Of course, Mueller's team got the emails through the General Services Administration. And the Trump team's accusation is that this is basically another example of the deep state that is out to get them. They allege that career workers at the GSA handed over these emails to Mueller's team when they should not have. This is something that is a little bit foggy, because typically this doesn't become an issue. Most of the time there wouldn't be a special prosecutor looking or asking for these transition emails in the first place, so there wouldn't really be any clear answer as to whether it's appropriate to turn them over or not. And there are conflicting opinions on this. It would seem that perhaps one of the key distinctions could be which accounts Trump officials were using at the time. One of my colleagues at the Post talked to Randall Eliason, who's a former federal prosecutor. He now teaches at George Washington Law School. But the way he put it was that, if you're not using your personal email and you were using a .gov email, which some of these officials might have been doing even before they were sworn in, he would say, look, you can't have any expectation of privacy. Whether you're on the government payroll yet or not, that's a public record. and it should be turned over. So what you might have is a situation where you're parsing, well, which emails were sent and received from .gov accounts, and others might have been coming from, you know, Trump.org accounts or something like that.
Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you. I thought there was an interesting editorial about the Mueller investigation written by Joel McNally recently, and he actually said that Republicans practiced some of the tactics they're trying out with the Mueller investigation on the John Doe investigation, where in both situations, one with Donald Trump, the other with Scott Walker, you had notable Republicans being investigated for something that seemed improper, and they came out with claims of partisanship. I mean, recently the texts have been used as an example against Mueller, where it was actually Republican partisans claiming partisanship on behalf of either independent investigators or investigators that were made up of bipartisan groups of people where you actually had Republicans and Democrats working together on the investigation.
Nate, thanks for the call, Cal, and that John Doe story is unique here to Wisconsin. But on a national level, there have been a lot of attacks on the integrity of the Mueller investigation.
No question. I'm not familiar with the specific editorial your caller is referencing, but he's certainly right that we are seeing familiar tactics here. Something I wrote about this week was the sort of familiarity of the attacks on Mueller if you look back to attacks that were lodged against Kenneth Starr, of course, who was the special counsel in the Whitewater investigation of Bill Clinton, you know, 20-plus years ago. And you see sort of the same arguments, you know, well, this is partisan. You know, in the case of Kenneth Starr, he was a Republican himself, and so of course some Democrats in the administration complained, well, he's from the opposition party. Kenneth Starr had considered a Senate run as a Republican. He'd been the Solicitor General under George H.W. Bush, and of course Clinton had defeated Bush, so the accusation was that maybe there is some sour grapes there and he's grinding an axe. I mean, these are the kinds of charges that you get. Mueller's a little bit different, right, because he's actually a registered Republican himself, just like Trump, but he has hired some attorneys on his team who are Democratic donors, and of course you've got the one FBI agent whose text messages have spilled into the open in the past week or so, in which he was exchanging anti-Trump sentiments with an FBI lawyer. So all of these things have sort of fueled a very familiar fire that allows, you know, whoever is under investigation by a special counsel to call into question the integrity of the probe.
Nate, thanks for that call. We're talking to Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, looking at the big stories in national politics this week. Want to check out the latest on sexual harassment issues in Congress. Some payouts from the Treasury Department. Some cases we know where they were going, and some cases we don't. What's the latest?
That's right. We're sort of slowly getting to more information on this, but we still sort of have a long way to go as well. So the Treasury Department says that it paid out something like $175,000over a few years, stemming from, I believe, it's 15 cases within the House, but we still don't have really much of a look into how the Senate has been handling its business. We also wouldn't know necessarily if members of Congress were settling complaints against them using their own funds. You know, this is just sort of whatever public dollars have been spent on the case. And of course, sort of the broader issue, which is sort of now under review in Congress, is, you know, what are the standards in place as far as confidentiality and disclosure? I think that most members of Congress agree at this point that if the victim or alleged victim in a case wants to remain private, that's one thing. But there are many cases in which they would like to speak out, but are prevented from doing so because they have been required to sign confidentiality agreements in order to obtain, in some cases, relatively small settlements.
And then a quick look at a couple other stories. Trump nominee for the Import-Export Bank was rejected. Scott Garrett was the nominee. A couple Republicans on a panel, on a committee, switched over and voted against him, I guess along the lines that he had talked previously about wanting to get rid of the Import-Export Bank.
Right. And one of those Republicans who switched over was Tim Scott of South Carolina, whom the president was praising effusively today at the tax bill celebration. So apparently he's not holding a grudge there. But you're right. That seemed to be the real hang-up for these Republicans was, hey, Scott Garrett, when you were in Congress, you voted twice against reauthorizing the Export-Import Bank. That's, by the way, not a fringe position. There are plenty of Republicans who also don't like that institution. But you'd figure that if you're going to head the Ex-Im Bank, then you maybe ought to actually be a fan of the organization that you're going to lead, and I think that was kind of the chief objection.
And finally, a quick look. Recently released information showing a Department of Defense research and investigation into unidentified flying objects. What has come out here?
Yeah, this is interesting stuff. To me, the most interesting so far has been some of the footage. You know, you've had a Navy fighter pilot sort of describing what he believes is his encounter in the sky with a UFO. And the thing that has also stood out to me is when you've heard the former director of this program in interviews, he has talked about really just sort of the focus, the really sober focus, I guess you could say, on national security. You know, he said, look, frankly, I don't know whether some of these apparent aircraft that we've seen in the sky come from China or Russia or Mars or your dog next door. And to some degree, I don't care. My job is to figure out whether it is a threat to our national security. That's the most important thing. And so what's sort of striking is this kind of two ways to look at it, which is that it fuels the conspiracy theories that are sort of fun to kick around. And then on the other hand, you see these sort of very serious sounding people within the government who have been leading this program sort of not really worrying too much about whether it comes from outer space or not and really just trying to think about how do we keep the country safe.
Once upon a time, this might have been a slow news week and we would have spent a lot more time looking at this UFO investigation. There's just too much going on now, huh?
There is. I suppose it's a good problem to have as we get toward the end of the year, because sometimes we sort of are limping to the finish line in a given year, but not this time around. There is plenty to talk about.
Callum, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
That's Callum Borchers. He covers the intersection of media and politics for The Fix at The Washington Post. He was with us for a weekly recap of national news.